It is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. I've really been looking forward to Sandy coming back. She shared in this room more than once and always brings a big crowd. They call her Handy Sandy for a reason. She really works this program. And she's been useful, very useful in a lot of other people's recoveries. It's my pleasure to request a warm round of applause for Sandy. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Wow. I'm done. Y'all go home. My name is Sandy, and I'm an alcoholic. A lot of people in the room, some people I know, lots of new faces that I don't. I'll start out by saying my sobriety date is August the 8th, 2003. This is the second room I ever came into to achieve sobriety. I got sober at the Biscayne room. And I want to start off, I always like to start off reading something that makes you kind of think about the disease of alcoholism. And I think that if you're in this room tonight, Monday night, listening to somebody talk about alcoholism, you're probably in the right place. But what I'm going to read comes from a very old book. And if you want to know what book it is, you can ask me after the meeting. But I'm going to read probably the best definition of alcoholism that I've ever heard. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaints? Who has needless bruises? Who has bloodshot eyes? Those who linger over wine, who sample mixed wine. Do not gaze at wine when it is red, because it sparkles in the cup and it goes down smoothly. But in the end, it bites like a vapor, like a viper. Your eyes will see strange sights and your mind will imagine confusing things. You will be like one sleeping on the high seas, lying on the top of the rigging. They hit me, you will say, but I'm not hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. When can I wake up so I can get another drink? So that was pretty much where I was when I decided to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was lost. I was hurt. I was lonely. I was in a lot of pain. And my alcoholism started at a very young age. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, by very young parents. They did the best they had, but I didn't get a whole lot of supervision. I was very, I grew myself up. I raised myself. I never had really any rules or regulations. My parents divorced when I was very young, so I kind of made things up as I went along. I had my first drink probably when I was about 13 or 14, and I remember it made me feel really good, and it made me want more. When I was 15 or so, I went to go live with my father. My mom had went through some problems, and I went to go live with my father, and it wasn't very good for me. My stepmom wasn't very much older than me and didn't like me much. And so I spent a lot of time drinking and forgetting about all that and going about my life. And my goal when I graduated from high school was to become a bartender, and that's what I did. I actually have a degree in mixology. I don't tell people that often, because that's a little embarrassing to think that an alcoholic had to go to school and pay a lot of money to learn how to mix a vodka tonic. And in the end, I was drinking right out of the bottle, so I didn't need any recipes anyway. But it did land me some really good jobs, and I got one DUI when I was 18 years old, and that was scary. But I thought, well, that's just what they did, and I'll date myself and say in 1984, I got a $300 fine and a year's probation. So I think that it's a little stiffer penalty now, and I'm really glad that I don't drink. And alcohol is a lot more expensive, too. It's like, wow, you know, it's not cheap anymore. Anyway, I got that DUI, and, you know, I went past that and moved about my life. And I was always very, very successful at everything that I tried to achieve, I achieved. I got very good jobs. I was likable. I was I'm a doer. I'm a taskmaster. I'm a go-getter. I was always very, very good at my jobs, even when I was drinking. I knew that something was wrong with me probably when I was in my 30s. And I started having this just horrible feeling of loneliness all the time. No matter where I was or who I was with or what I was doing or where I was drinking or who I was with, I just couldn't seem to get that loneliness out of me. And I became a very mean, angry person, and I ran off some really, really good people in my life. But I want to share my bottom. I don't like to talk a whole lot about the drinking, but I need to qualify myself as an alcoholic. I drank a lot. I drank all the time. I drank a lot of drinks I didn't want to drink. Probably about a year before I quit drinking, I remember we were drinking that green stuff that comes in a square bottle, and there just happened to be some of it left over the next day, and I remember having the shakes so badly that I had to stand over the sink and throw up a few times before I could get some down, you know, and I remember thinking, this doesn't seem normal. This doesn't seem right. So I eventually got out of the bar business. I was in it for 25 years, and I was very, very successful at it. I got a title as a food and beverage manager, and alcoholism was really kicking me at that time, and I knew that at the time I thought, it's the job, you know? I just need a different job. And they were on to me. They were about to find out how much I was stealing, and I have to admit that. I never thought that I was a thief, but when you drink and you don't pay for it, and when you give free drinks away in order to make more money, and you lie about the liquor cost, and you take bottles of alcohol home with you, and you do all those things, you are a thief. I thought a thief meant I'm not reaching into the cash register and pulling money out, but I was. So that was a hard thing to deal with, but I knew they were on to me, and I had to get out of the bar business. So I had always wanted to be in the plant business. I was with a significant other at the time, and he was a great enabler, because by the time I got out of the bar business and into the plant business, my car had already been repossessed, because, you know, when you don't pay for your car, they come and get it in the middle of the night, and then you have to act like it's no big deal, you know. Oh, that old thing, that was costing me more money anyway. Now I don't have to pay insurance and car payments. I only had $1,200 on that car, and I let it go because I didn't have, at the time, my level of pride was too high to call my parents and say, hey, I got a problem, and could you help me get my car back? So I let that car go. My bottom occurred when I was in this relationship with this person, and alcohol made me very angry. Did it make anybody else angry? Anybody? Head shaking? Yeah. At first, it worked really good, and I was the life of the party, and then I became the girl that, like, after the party, they were like, Sandy, do you remember what you did last night? And then it became I was no longer invited to the party, and then when I didn't have a car, I couldn't get to the party, even if I was invited. And I knew, really, that repossession was really a blessing, because I had no business having a driver's license. I had no business driving, because at the end of my drinking, I drank every day. I drank in the mornings. I drank in the afternoons. I drank in the evenings. I was pretty much drunk all the time. I got pulled over 2 weeks ago in my neighborhood by a Roswell cop, and he actually let me go. But I was thinking 10 years ago, I would have been on the way to jail, you know, because I would not have been sober at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when school was letting out. I can assure you of that. But my alcoholism made me very angry, and, you know, who do we take it out on? The people that we love the most and the people that are closest to us, because they'll put up with us, basically. So my bottom was I was working at Lowe's at the time in the plant section, and I'm going to tell a little story here. I'm going to divert off because Tinsley likes this story, so I'm going to share it. I worked at Lowe's in the lawn and garden and outdoor power equipment area for many, many years, and the joke is that I was certified on every forklift that they have, and I've never driven a forklift sober, ever in my life, because I quit there when I got sober. So, you know, those times times when you're at Lowe's or Home Depot and they block off the aisles because they're getting something off the top, be grateful because it could have been me, you know, and I could have dropped something on someone's head. So I'm really, really grateful that I didn't hurt anybody at work. I didn't, because it's not a good thing. But anyway, one night I had been out drinking after work, and I came home, and we'll just say I wanted something from my significant other, and he wasn't willing to give me that, and so I physically harmed him, and I had physically harmed him numerous times, but he had had enough, and I was arrested for simple battery, and you know, I remember that night. I'm glad I remember that night, but barely. I remember bits and pieces, but what I do remember about that night is I knew I was going to jail, so I went and got dressed, and I took my bottle, and I went into a closet, and I drank until the cops got there and took me to jail. And, you know, the guy at the time was like, oh, I really don't want you to take her to jail. I just want you to, you know, calm her down, you know. And he's got a big knot on his head. And, you know, and I'm just a belligerent idiot waiting in a closet for the cops to come arrest me. So it was not pretty. And so I went over to Memorial Drive. Maybe some of you guys have been over there before. Anybody? Yeah. And they put this really cute orange jumpsuit on me, and they put me in this little room with this cold, you know. Now, I've been to jail before. I confess I've been to jail 3 times for simple battery in my life. Like I said, alcohol made me angry. A really pivotal thing happened that night when I was in jail. I was in jail. I was in a holding cell with a girl, and she was in there for solicitation of drugs, which means she was doing what she needed to do to get what she needed to get. And I gave her my blanket, and I gave her my apple, you know. And the next morning, man, it was cold, and I could care less about the apple, but I sure wish I would have kept that blanket. But they separated us up, and about 6 or 7 hours later, we went before the judge. And the judge, you know, we're both sitting in the orange jumpsuits next to each other. And see, I thought myself to be better because she was a drug addict, and I'm an alcoholic, you know. We're so much better, right? And I looked over, and there that same girl was, and she looked over at me, and she said, I don't know what you drank last night, but you stink. And that was when the playing field was really leveled for me. That was when I realized that I'm no better, no different, no worse. Addiction is addiction. And we were in the same jumpsuit before the same judge in the same institution. So there was really no difference. And I'm really grateful for what she said to me that day, because that was when I had my I had a moment of clarity. Oh, I mean, I felt terrible. I was super hungover, and, you know, I looked awful. I've been able to glance upon that lovely picture on this lovely website that they have now. That they, some of you probably know about that too, where they, you know, try to get you to pay a lot of money to get yourself taken off these public records. But, you know, at this point, I'm okay with it being out there, and if anybody questions me, you know, I have some pretty good track record now of being sober. So anyway, I had to call my mother. I'd never called my mother before to bail me out. I was pretty functional even at my worst, and she made me promise that I would get some help. So I went home, and I told this person that, you know, I knew that I needed to be sober, and I wasn't going to be able to be sober in this relationship. Too much harm had been done by me. Now, he had his faults, but it's never okay to hurt people physically, and I realize that now. And it was just really me acting out because I hated myself so much, you know, but I'd look pretty stupid going around beating up on myself, so I chose to abuse the people that I cared about. I also, you know, omitted my family because I was embarrassed. I was ashamed of myself, so I didn't spend a whole lot of time with my family, and a lot of things I missed and a lot of things I should have been there, but that's a whole different now. I'll talk about that a little later. But so I moved out immediately, and after I got out of jail, a course, I went home and I drank the rest of the bottle that was left in the closet, because what are you going to do? I mean, I'm not going to waste it, you know. And then I called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's easy to find. Back then, we still used the phone book. I know it was only 10 years ago, but there was still a phone book. You know, we don't really have them much anymore, but AA is one of the first numbers in there. So if you're ever looking for it. But I called and they recommended that I call a place called the Biscayne Room, the Atlanta Biscayne Room. That was where I went for my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I sat in there and, wow, you know, I knew I was in the right place from the first moment people started talking and they started sharing their experience, strength, and hope, which I didn't know what that was at the time. I thought they were just, I knew they were telling the truth, but it was so good to hear people saying things out loud that I had been holding inside because of the shame and the embarrassment of it, you know. And I knew I was home. So I did everything everybody said to do. I got a sponsor and I went to meetings and did all the stuff, you know. And I got really, really restless about 100 days in. And I decided, and I was still at Lowe's at this time, and I decided that I was going to go to a doctor and manipulate him for something to help me rest, we'll just say. And I'm a pure alcoholic, but if anything was around and I was good enough in the bag, the answer was yes, you know. But alcohol was always my drug of choice and always will be, even though I don't drink it anymore. It still sometimes is appealing to me, and I'll tell you a story about that, too. I was very, very irritable, and I was also partaking in some of that smokable alcohol. I didn't know at that time, because I've never been an Alcoholics Anonymous before, that sober meant like actually sober, like don't do anything, you know. Let me back up. I knew I wasn't doing something right because I wasn't telling my sponsor about that smokable alcohol. So, but the problem with the smokable alcohol was it quit working, you know. I mean, I was doing good. At first I was like, cool, this is working. I'm not drinking. I'm not getting in trouble. I'm not being hungover. I'm going to meetings. This is good, you know. And then one day it didn't work. So I manipulated this doctor for some anti-anxiety medication, and when I was standing outside of the pharmacy, and I called my sponsor, and I said, you know, I haven't been eating, I haven't been sleeping, I'm just so like a focus, I can't concentrate, and I said, you know, I got this medication, and you know, I'm going to go in and get it filled, and she said, you can't do that, and I was like, excuse me, it's not alcohol, you know. I did. I went in and filled it, and of course I immediately abused it. I was supposed to take like a half of one in the morning and a half of one at night, and I think they only gave me 5. Well, the deal was when those ran out, I needed some alcohol. So my meeting was over at 6 o'clock over on Claremont, and that day on my lunch break was when I usually went to my AA meetings. Instead of making a right and going to the Biscayne Room, I made a left and went to the liquor store, and I drank, and it was really bad. I don't recommend it. I do not recommend it at all. What it did to me after 100 days, I would hate to think of what it might do after 10 plus years. It might kill me, you know, and I'm not willing to take that chance, because it was like every hangover I'd ever had all wrapped up into one. I was sick here, I was sick there, I was, you know, dehydrated, I was vomiting, I was sweating, and then that's not even including the detox that I had to go back through again after the drinking. And it was very unpleasant, but it had to happen and it was necessary for me. I don't think that alcohol relapse is necessary, but for me, I needed that because I needed to prove to myself that drinking was not going to work for me anymore. And boy, did I prove it. When I got up the next day, well, when I came to the next day, I had been drinking red wine, and it looked like I'd painted my apartment with red wine. underneath my bed, was one footprint in red wine. I don't know yet how that happened. I haven't been able to figure that one out. I don't know how it happened. I worried my friends. I worried my family. They were scared to death. People from my job that knew that I was trying to get sober had came and knocked on my door and, you know, tried to get me out of my house. And I was just so filled with shame. I only drank one night, but the shame, you know, because I thought, gosh, these people have been so good to me and so kind to me, and they've done that. We're going to love you till you love yourself and keep coming back and all that great stuff. And I just knew I disappointed everybody. So after about a week of detoxing in my apartment, I called my sponsor and I said, oh my gosh, you're not going to believe this, but I drank. And she was like, oh yeah, I saw that coming. It's not a surprise. And I was like, really? She's like, oh yeah, you know, I knew you were going to do it before you even went to that pharmacy. I knew you were going to do it. And I was like, okay. She goes, well, are you ready to get back on the beam? And I said, yeah. So I went and picked up a white chip, and I did a lot of bouncing around that night when I was drunk, bouncing off walls or whatever, but I had a carpet burn on the whole right side of my face. I was bruised, you wouldn't believe. I mean, I was bruised here, I was bruised here, I was bruised here, I was bruised here. I don't know what I did. I really have no recollection. It was almost like an immediate blackout. I remember the first bottle, but after the first bottle, I don't remember much. So I went and picked up the chip. And after that meeting, another pivotal thing happened. You know, if you stay around long enough in AA, you hear a whole lot of stuff that you hear all the time. But every once in a while, somebody will tell you something that really sticks with you. And after that meeting, a guy, he pulled me to the side and he said, I want to share a story with you. And I said, okay. I wasn't feeling too good. I was like, whatever. You know, I had completely surrendered. So he sat me down on the couch and he said, there was a girl that used to come here. And she looked a little bit like you. She was a little younger than you, but she left a meeting one night and she went home and she drank. She stopped by the liquor store and she drank and she died. She died in her apartment all alone. Her parents found her a few days later. Her dog was in there with her. They had to quarantine her dog. It was a real horrific story. More details than I'm telling right now, but he said, and if you think I'm trying to scare you by telling you that, I am. He said, the disease of alcoholism kills. It wants to get us alone so it can kill us. That's the ultimate goal of alcoholism. It wants to kill me. And I was so grateful for that story. And I'll tell you what, it scared the crap out of me. But I was ready for action. So I immediately started working the steps with my first sponsor. And she was really tough. She was one of those ones that was like, I'd call, like, somebody caught me off in traffic. I'm going to go drink, you know. Or somebody was mean to me. Or, you know, so-and-so didn't answer the phone and I called them four times. And she'd say, well, read page 84, 85, and 86 and call me tomorrow after you pray. And let me know how you feel about it in 24 hours. I'm like, really? But I needed that because I was really hard-headed and I was deep, deep, deep in self-pity. I was so stuck in self. I was so self-absorbed. It was poor, pitiful me, and you guys would drink too, you know, if you had the problems that I had. And now, looking back, I really didn't have that bad of problems. You know, I had people that loved me. I had a great family that loved me. I had a job. I somehow managed to have a job. It was all internal. I was miserable. And so we did the steps, and she took me through them, and I'll never forget, you know, my first fourth step. I went to her house. I'd been carrying this thing around for like a month in my car because she was trying to slow me down because I'm a doer. I'm like, no, 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 get this done, knock this out. And she kept putting me off, and I was like, God, why is she doing this, you know? She wanted me to learn how to, what is that we say, take it easy. I finally have learned that by age more than actual application of taking it easy, you know, just the sheer aging process has slowed me down tremendously. But I finally, we finally sat down and did that fifth step, and I threw out the worst thing that I could think of that was was on my list, and she shared something with me that was much worse. She shared with me that she had hit a pedestrian and almost killed them when she was drinking and driving, and I felt bad for that, and I often feel bad when I listen to Fifth Steps, but I'm so grateful that it's an exchange. You know, this thing that we're doing, it's not a one-way street. It's a two-way street. You share something with me, I share something with you. We get to know each other. We care about each other. We start calling. We get back into the groove of life. We have friends. We go for coffee. We go to meetings. You know, this is how we get back into life. Because I don't know about you guys, but I was drinking in a closet, you know. It wasn't a whole lot. There wasn't a disco ball, and there weren't, like, you know, people dancing all around me or anything. It was very, very lonely, very lonely. And we got all the way up to step 9. And at step 9, she was going through some problems in her personal life, and it was time for me to get another sponsor, and I'm still friends with this sponsor. Still love her, wish her well. She had some troubles, and I see her around occasionally, and she helped me tremendously. So my second sponsor, I was sitting over in self-pity one day over at the Biscayne Room. They have a bar at the Biscayne Room. I don't know. If you guys have never been there, it's awesome because they have a bar there, you know. You can actually go and sit at the bar. You drink coffee, but you can sit at the bar. I love bars. To this day, I still love bars. I go and play pool in a bar once a week. I'm on a pool league, but I have a reason to be there. I'm playing pool. But I've always loved that feel, you know. And that's just the way I am. Still, you know, I enjoy hanging out. You know, if I'm there to listen to music, play pool, if there's something there for me, I'm there, but I can't just go and sit and do nothing. But anyway, I was sitting over there, and I was just in a mess. I was about to lose my apartment. I was about 6 months sober, six or seven months sober, I guess. And a gentleman came in over there, and he's this big, scruffy dude that's been sober forever, and I call him the crusty old-timers, and I mean that with a term of endearment. If you have more than 20 years and you're here, thank you. Thank you. He said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I don't know how I'm going to pay my rent, and I don't know what I'm going to do, this is what sober is. Why am I even doing it?" You know, just pathetic. I was using that old tool that we girls have to manipulate to get what we want. And I was thinking, this is working, you know. And he said, "Well, how much is your rent?" And I told him, and he walked out to his car, and he came back, and he brought a checkbook. And I said, "I don't even have a job. I left my job at Lowe's. You know, I'm trying to start this cleaning business. It's not going so well." And he goes, "Well, I'm going to give you a job." I was like, "Well, I don't have a car." "Well, I'll come pick you up." I was like, "Okay." So, you know, I thought naturally that, you know, me being, I was about 40 pounds heavier, very puffy and swollen. I had really big, crazy hair. You know, I was looking really good, you know. And I thought, "Oh, he wants me. That's what it is." I mean, I'm serious. That was what I was thinking. I was like, "Yeah, I'm a hot commodity here, you know." What is it? We're egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. That was totally me. So, anyway, he wrote me a check, and he said, "You're going to work for me." He sold antiques at Lakewood when Lakewood was still in business, and he said, "You're going to work for me. You're going to make $8 an hour. I'm going to come pick you up, and I'm going to drop you off. You're going to do exactly what I tell you to do. You're never going to make any more than $8 an hour, and you're going to pay me back this money." And he wrote me a check, and I paid my rent. I did actually pay my rent, you know. So I got another day, and the beauty of that person was that, you know, when he used to share in meetings, I was like, you know, did not like him. And he turned out to be one of the people that helped me the most. So, you know, pay attention to the message and not the messenger is the lesson I got from that. Anyway, he also introduced me to my second sponsor, because one night he dropped me off from work, and I said, "You know, I got to ask you a question. Why are you helping me? Do you want to get something going on with me?" And he laughed in my face. I mean, like a hearty ho 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 Santa Claus laugh in my face. And I'm like, and he was like, "No." He goes, "I'm helping you because that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. If we can, we're supposed to help people, and I'm helping you." And he said, "By the way, you don't know who my fiance is, but she's a woman in the program with over 17 years, and I think you should meet her." And she became my second sponsor. You know, God always just keeps plugging those people right in those spots, you know. And she was just, this woman was just the best. And, you know, I met her and I was really confused because I'm a Christian and she was Jewish. And I was like, this is not going to work. See how alcoholism does, you know. Even though I've read enough in the room, you know, that it's a God of your understanding. But my mind was like, oh, this will never work. Well, it did work and it worked great. And she taught me more about God than anybody probably than I've ever dealt with. She told me that I was a child of God and I was a person of worth. And then she did this really crappy thing to me. And she made me go back, all the way back to step one and start the steps all over again. Man, was I mad at her. But in hindsight, I was really grateful because I learned some more things about myself that I did not know. And now, I was looking at some stuff this afternoon and yesterday, just reminiscing, because I always like to go through things when I'm about to do this. And my first fourth step was just like, so about everybody else. It was everybody else's fault. And then when I did it again, I was able to be a little more honest with myself. And, you know, now I could do a fourth step right here in front of you in a minute. You know, I'm not going to, but I mean, it's just as simple as I'm angry at, because what does it affect? What could I have done differently? End of story. So if you haven't done a fourth step, just do it. It's good stuff. It really is. It's very freeing. Very, very freeing. Because I didn't want to carry that bag of rocks. I'd been carrying that bag of rocks for a long time. I started drinking when I was 15 and I quit when I was 38. So my back was tired. Anyway, so she took me through the steps again and, you know, just was just super awesome. And I got in a real unhealthy relationship and it caused me a lot of pain and it caused a lot of problems between she and I. And then it was time for me to get another sponsor. And, you know, that's the cool thing. That's okay. It's okay to change home groups. It's okay to change sponsors. It's okay to go to a different meeting. It's okay to have coffee with different people. All that's cool, you know, as long as you don't drink. It's really okay to change things up. As a matter of fact, every time I've done something different, I've expanded myself. I've learned something more about me. I've grown, and thus we grow. So the sponsor that I have now, I've had her since 2008, and I've pretty much done all the work, and I didn't drink, but I asked her to take me through the book again. And we sat down. The relationship that I was in had hurt me to such a degree that I was shut down. You know, I would go to meetings and I was just in so much emotional pain and I didn't know how to get out of it. I didn't know what to do. And the meeting, the 9:30 meeting over here in this room, pretty much literally saved my life. And there's some people that I sat in the room with that are in here right now and shared that pain with me and helped me get through it. And because it's a pretty crappy place to be when you don't want to drink and you don't want to live anymore. And sometimes that emotional pain is just, it's hard. That's the hardest thing about getting sober. You got to feel stuff, you know. So I started going to another program that helps the friends and families of alcoholics, and that took me to another level, and that really, really helped me too. It made me a better sponsor. It made me a better friend. It made me a better spouse. It makes me a better daughter. It makes me a better sister. It helps me set boundaries, and I went through the 12 steps there. They're the same 12 steps, you know. I mean, AA is the pinnacle. Everything else is just, you know, a level down. But that really, really helped me. And the sponsor that I have now is just like, you know, after we went through the steps, she's a great friend. And, you know, ever since I've known her, she'd always wanted to have a child, and it just never happened the way she wanted. And about 6 months ago, she adopted a baby girl. And, you know, I was able to participate in that and be there for her, you know. And that's when, like, it comes full circle, when you can actually be there for your sponsor. It's an awesome feeling, you know, when you can sit and go, oh, I'm sorry you're going through that. And you can actually give them some suggestions. It's really, really cool. And, you know, so now she's a mom. She's a single mom. And she's been sober a little over a year longer than me. And some people in the room know her. And she's an awesome person. I mean, I wouldn't... She pulled me. She and a group of friends pulled me through something that I didn't want to drink, but boy, it was tough. So I say to that, if you go through those kind of emotional upheavals, you just don't drink. You lean into the program. I always make this analogy. We ride motorcycles, and you know, when you're going into a curve on a motorcycle, your natural reaction is to lean out because, oh my God, if you lean in, you're going to fall over. But it's exactly the opposite. It's that way here too. But once again, the disease of alcoholism, when you're going through pain, it wants to pull you away. It wants to tell you you're not good enough and you're not worthy and you'll never have anybody to love you. It takes you right back to that same old place, man. You know, and even if you hadn't drank in a long time, it will still take you to that place. So you have to lean in. You got to lean in and rely on people and be very particular of who you rely on. You know, my Al-Anon sponsor says you can't join a fellowship of sick people and expect them to act well all the time. And that's true, you know. And I've been guilty of not acting so well myself. I'm not throwing a stone. I'm speaking the truth. You know, there's been times when I have done things. I have made amends as recently as a month ago. I've done a 10-step immediately. I didn't want to, but I did. That let go and let God thing is not easy either. But so, you know, where I am now with my recovery is every year that goes by that I'm sober, I find something else about me that I did not know. Some of the stuff is cool, and some of the stuff is like, there that is again. But I've started doing some things that I never thought I would do. I have reconnected my relationship with my mother and my father. And, you know, I guess that's a natural process as we get older. God, I wished I would have done it before, though, you know, because... Anyway, in September, my mom asked me to go to an art class with her. And much like probably a lot of the women in the room, it's, the mother-daughter dynamic can be very difficult. It's either awesome or it's like, oh. I mean, I remember when I first got sober, I used to pray before I'd go see my mom. She was very difficult. Very difficult. Wonder where I got it from, you know. She's not an alcoholic, but her drug of choice is control. And I love her, and she's my mom. And you know, I open my mouth sometimes, and she comes out. You know, and I used to think that was a horrible thing, and now I think it's a wonderful thing. You know, I'm like my mom, awesome. You know, and it was very turbulent. And what happened with my mom? I wanted our relationship to be what I wanted it to be, like those Steel Magnolias and all those ones. You know, where the mother and daughter make peace. And it's wonderful, and they shop together and do all this and that. And it didn't happen. Our relationship got worse, but what ended up happening was my mom got breast cancer. And as a result of that, my mom had her very own spiritual awakening that had absolutely nothing to do with me. And now we are close, and we did go on that mother-daughter trip, and we went on a painting class, 3-day painting class in Tennessee, and I didn't know it, but I can paint. And it only took me 48 years to figure it out. I can paint. Not great, but, you know, people seem to like it, and I sure enjoy doing it. Some of the other things, you know, I've repaired the relationship with my father and my stepmom. I have repaired a lot of relationships. I've also had to let a lot of relationships go. And that's a hard thing in the recovery. A girl that goes to my home group said something that stuck with me. She said it about 3 weeks ago. I brought a little issue that I was having to the group. And she said, you know, I had to make some friends, acquaintances, and I had to make some family members, relatives. And I was like, wow, that's good stuff. It seems pretty basic, but the way she said it really hit home to me at that time. And I've learned that... sobriety is the most important thing for me. And I also learned that no matter what, I'm going to be okay. Not I'm going to be okay, I am okay. I know that things are going to happen, and one of the things that used to frighten me the most when I was early in sobriety was that if something ever happened to my parents, which the natural course is that that's supposed to happen. They're supposed to go for us. But I used to always carry that little loophole that if something happened to my parents, I might have to drink. Well, when I was about 4 or 5 years sober, a really good friend of mine came into this room, and he was with his sponsor, and he was sitting right over there. It was at the 11 o'clock meeting, and he came in, and he was sober, and he was devastated. His father had been killed in a car accident the night before, and he came in, and he shared his pain with the group. And when he did that, there went that loophole, you know. Well, he can do it. I've seen people go through cancer. I've seen people lose family. I've seen people lose friends. I've seen people go through divorces. I've seen people lose children. And I've seen them stay sober. And that's when I come to AA, because I need to be reminded. I am an alcoholic. And a funny thing happened the other day. I'm going to close with this. I could talk forever because I just love this program and it's so saved my life, man. I mean, I just, when I look in this room and I see all these people, and I mean, gosh, if you're here, you just, we're so lucky. We're so lucky. Thank God Bill and Bob figured this out in that room smoking cigarettes all day long. So that when we got here, for me, let's see, what is it, 77, 78 years, and I've been sober 10 years, so 60-something years ago, they already had figured this out, and it was waiting here for me with the steps and the traditions and the concepts and the meetings and the fellowship and the service and the unity. Wow, you know? So I am reminded that I'm an alcoholic every once in a while, and it jumps right up in my face. This happened the other night. I was on my way to a party with Steve, my husband, and we were going to a party with those normal drinkers. I don't know how normal they are. They drink pretty darn hard, and they're my age. I'm like, God, I can't imagine having a hangover. But they drink hard, but they're my friends, and they have a beautiful house, and they throw great parties, and we were on our way over, and we had to stop by the liquor store to get something. And we go in, and I do this frequently, because I don't think about it anymore, you know, or so I thought. So we walk in, and Steve goes over to the left side where the hard liquor is, and it was a wine shop, and wine was always my thing. And I didn't really pay much attention. I just kind of walked in, and then I looked around to the right, and oh my God, there were things sparkly, shiny. This whole right side was just like, I'm serious. I'm serious. And I walked over to Steve and I said, I can never come back here again. Because it was just, it wasn't that I wanted it, but it was just beautiful, you know. And I mean, I'm telling you this because I'm being honest. Sometimes I can see that perfect, thin-lipped, perfect stemmed wine glass and I think, wow, if I could only have one. But I have never had one. I've never had one of anything. And that's what reminds me that I'm an alcoholic. A gentleman that I got sober with over at Biscayne, we used to have a little noon meeting, and one day he said another powerful thing to me. He said, when you're done drinking, it's easy to get to AA, but it's hard to stay. It's hard to stay. And that is a powerful, powerful thing. And I'll tell you, I still sponsor. I have two sponsees right now. I have one that's actually going through the traditions with me. How many of you guys have had that luck? I was like, whoa, you're like the, I'm giving you a gold star for the best sponsee ever. You know, I've been sponsoring a lot of girls, and none of them have ever asked me to take them through the traditions. I still get up and I do readings every day. I pray every day. I do a gratitude list, and I also do a written prayer every day. Every day I try to talk to at least one alcoholic. Most of the time it's more. And I still attend probably 2 to 3 meetings a week. And that's, you know, with 10 plus years. And sometimes more. And that's what I do. And I have to never, ever forget that I'm an alcoholic. Because alcoholism is a disease, and it really wants to get me, even now. Because that scared me the other day in that wine store. I'm going to tell you, that scared me. Because I think of myself as pretty spiritually fit, that I'm doing this stuff, you know. But just like that, you know, it's cunning, baffling, powerful, subtle. and it wants to get all of us. So just for today and just for tonight, it didn't get me. And my prayer is that I hope that something I've said has helped somebody. And no matter how much time you have, this program works, and it works real good, and it saved my life, and I'm eternally grateful. So thanks a lot, everybody, for being here. I really appreciate it.
Wow. Thank you so much, Sandy. That was awesome.
Nothing more you need.